Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Anna Mae Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talked to Martin Bauman, communications specialist for the Canadian Mental Health Association, Waterloo Wellington. There's been a lot of talk about mental health issues in this election. All the parties have included it in their platform in some way, more money, more access, and more services for mental health needs. But what do those working in the mental health sector need? Is more money all there is to it, or do we need more understanding about mental health's place in the overall healthcare system? That sounds like a pretty good place to begin with. Mental health is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. So let's run down a few statistics. In any given year, one in five Canadians experiences a mental illness or addiction problem. By the time Canadians reach 40 years of age, one in two have or have had a mental illness. Over 4,000 Canadians per year die by suicide at a rate of almost 11 suicides per day on average. Now that affects people of all ages and backgrounds as well. And in any given week, at least 500,000 employed Canadians are unable to work due to mental health problems. And that includes approximately 355,000 disability cases due to mental and or behavioral disorders, and approximately 175,000 full-time workers who are absent from work due to a mental illness. That economic burden caused by mental illness in Canada is estimated to be $51 billion per year, and that includes healthcare costs, lost productivity, and reductions in health-related quality of life. In other words, this is not small potatoes we're talking about. Now, on the front line of mental health awareness and treatment in our community is the CMHA, the Canadian Mental Health Association for Waterloo Wellington, which provides a full system of care for those with addictions, mental health, or developmental needs. They serve everyone from children to adults to seniors, and it's all under one roof with programs to help individuals and families lead lives filled with meaning and promise. About 350 CMHA staff members work out of offices in Cambridge, Waterloo, Kitchener, Guelph, Fergus, and Mount Forest, while also providing visiting or satellite services in Arthur, Shelburne, Erin, and Palmerston. It's one of the largest CMHA branches in the country, working in a sector that's only growing in need. So given all that, the incredibly large and broad scope of the issue, it may be unreasonable to expect two people to solve the problem in a half-hour podcast. Still, even in the midst of an election, it's important to leave politics aside and talk to the people that know an issue and hear directly from them what they need, the help they require, be it financial, administrative, or resource-based. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, Bauman will be our guide to the good work of the CMHA and where they see the gaps in assistance that they need to provide better service. We talk about the economics of mental illness, how poverty and housing issues come into play, and whether greater awareness and reduced stigmatization of mental illness is revealing the greater need than was previously known to exist. We also talk about whether or not mental health is looked at too often in its own silo and whether it should be integrated into the bigger health picture. And because this is a political show, Bauman will also talk about the present support for mental health given by the Ontario government. So I caught up with Martin Bauman last week in studio. So Martin Bauman, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
First of all, not that you need to establish your credentials, but for people listening and want to know about what the CMHA does and what you do there, could you talk a little about that?
Sure. Yeah. So Canadian Mental Health Association, that's CMHA. We are both a national and provincial and local not-for-profit organization specializing in mental health and addictions. And here in Waterloo, Wellington, we do developmental services too. We are the CMHA Waterloo, Wellington. That's my family anyway. And we serve everyone within Waterloo Region and Wellington County. That's Guelph, mm-hmm. Fergus, Mount Forest, it's Kitchener, it's Waterloo, it's Cambridge, and all of the rural communities between those places. And so
how many people is that?
Well, a lot of people within Waterloo Region and Wellington County. We're actually the biggest CMHA in Canada. Mm-hmm. If you talk about people that we serve, and I think just in terms of the number of people that actually work at CMHA Waterloo Wellington, the number of programs that we offer, we are pretty big, which mm-hmm. makes us unique in this area to be able to have that resource at hand. I kind of feel like an outsider because I'm not a social worker. I don't have that background. I got into it because I'm passionate about mental health and it's important to me. And so to come into that and see that, it's kind of cool. This is my home too. And so to mm-hmm. know that that there is such a resource here makes me pretty proud.
I don't know the exact number, but I would say probably 750,000, which is pretty big.
It is, yeah. Yeah, especially when you talk about, I mean, Canada is still pretty spread out there yeah. in terms of pockets of our communities where yeah. people live. So it's a big community, and especially when you know the numbers of just how many people are affected by mental health and addictions. I mean, the numbers are repeated ad nauseum by now of yeah. 1 in 5 in any given year. That's a lot of people.
I did want to get to that right off the top that... it does seem we are talking a lot more about mental health.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about a lot of things, but you know, are we sort of more aware now, or are we just, you know, maybe there's more openness, to being able to talk about it. You know, it's a question of, I guess, how you look at it. Either people are okay talking about mental health issues now or more okay, or we're just sort of better at knowing how to find mental health issues in people.
Yeah, well, I think we are getting better at it. And I think you see that in the stories of people that have come forward. I think mm-hmm. it always helps when celebrities and people with a public platform come forward mm-hmm. and share their stories. For me, I'm a basketball fan, so guys like DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love have been recent examples of that. Mm-hmm. Michael Phelps, Olympian, decorated Olympian, a great example of that. I mean, Clara Hughes has been such a champion in our country. Mm-hmm. And so anybody like that with a platform who speaks up and shares their experiences, I think that's great and that's part of it. I think initiatives like Bell Let's Talk Day is another part of it. And so all of these things, I think, have made it more comfortable for Canadians to speak about mental health and what they're going through. That being said, it's still not an easy thing to do. And right. so, I mean, I know that from experience, from myself being somebody who has a story to tell. But I know just how hard it is to get it out there and want to share. And so I think that's part of it is that, yes, attitudes are changing, but we're not quite there yet. But also, it's one thing to talk and talk and talk. And we've talked for a long time about mental health. But it's another thing to step up and actually fund mental health and right. provide the supports and services because it's tough. People are falling through the cracks because it is hard to get by with the level of funding that's out there to provide for the need that is there.
Yeah, and in so much as I don't want to talk about party platforms, but I think all the parties have in their platforms more funding for mental health. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone's going to come out against more funding for mental health, but... I wonder how much this can make a difference, just like the promise of more mm-hmm. funding, and whether it sort of perpetuates an idea that we treat mental health separate from physical health.
Right, yeah.
That, you know, this is a separate problem rather than being part of the larger package of just looking after the health of people.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a pretty safe political stance to say that you're in favor of supporting people better. Absolutely. And I think it is encouraging. I don't know how much, I mean, you are Guelph Politico, so I don't know how much you want to get into the nitty-gritty of things. But yes, it's encouraging to see that our major parties are committing to more mental health funding. Mm-hmm. I'm also aware that it is campaign season and we don't mm-hmm. always see the things that are mentioned in the campaign actually come to fruition.
Right.
So I'm hopeful that mental health would not be one of those things and that whoever ends up making those decisions after June will still remember that and put that as a priority. I think it is about recognizing that mental health is like physical health, and that's what the Canadian Mental Health Association has been really kind of pushing to get people to realize lately. I've been really encouraged by a campaign that we're a part of and that a lot of people have taken up and made their own called Erase the Difference. Mm. It's something that started with our partners at CMHA Ontario, and it is exactly that. It's realizing that there's this funding for health in general, physical health, mm-hmm. and then there's a portion of that which is allocated to mental health and addictions. And so if you were to look at 2017, I believe Ontario's provincial budget for all of health spending was $54 billion. Mm. Of that, $6.5 billion was mental health and addiction. So that's 6.5%.
One out of every $9.
Yeah, sorry, I said 6.5%. Not $6.5 billion, but 6.5%.
Yeah.
was allocated towards mental health and addictions. And that's actually, if you're to compare it to countries like New Zealand, to compare it to countries like the United Kingdom, we're lagging behind. They're at 10 or 11%. Not for me to get bogged down in numbers here.
But, no.
But we are falling short where we could be doing better. And so it's about recognizing that there is a gap there in terms of, sure, maybe we're talking about mental health more, but we're not funding it the same as other physical illnesses, despite the talk that it is the same as any other physical illness.
Right.
The attitudes have changed, but I think the funding has yet to catch up to that.
Can you give some examples of where the gaps are, from where you're sitting at the Waddlington and Waterloo region?
Well, yeah, the gaps, I think the sorts of things that you see that gap manifested in or the signs of that is people ending up on wait lists for programs. Mm-hmm. Because one of the challenges is, and it's a, you know, as much as we want people to be talking about mental health and to be talking about addictions issues or being in crisis, it's great. We want people to talk so that they can get that help because that's step number one.
Right.
But what happens if you have more people talking about it, but you can't actually provide help to those people? There are wait lists.
Right.
And so now you have a greater backlog of people that need that support. And as great as our teams are, and it's not just us, it's any community service provider, I think, as much as those people are dedicated and invested in helping people, there's not much you can do when you can't hire more staff to help those people, or you can't find other ways of getting those wait lists to be shortened. And so that's right. One thing that you see is that funding gap manifested in people ending up on wait lists for programs or services for counseling, where, you know, if you're to have a physical problem, you're not going to wait weeks and weeks to get a cast on a broken arm.
Right.
But you could end up waiting weeks or months to see a counselor for something. Or for that matter, another issue would be supportive housing, part of the puzzle that I think goes into mental health, because it's not just about the actual treatment of seeing a counselor or getting medication, but it's about the social factors around that. Do you have a supportive community? Do you have a safe, secure place to sleep every night? Are you aware where your next meal is going to come from? Or do you have that meaningful life quality? And so it's all of these things which are all lagging, which we need to kind of shore up.
Well, and that's where we kind of see the crossover with physical health care, because, you know, mental health workers are specialists, and there are long wait times for certain types of specialists as well. You know, orthopedic surgeons do like knee replacement. You know, if you get 6 month waiting list, you're considered lucky. So, I mean, it's another reason to look at it as part of the broader mental health picture, that we have people waiting for months to get access to specialized services in the medical profession.
That's right. And so my hope, and I think anyone's hope who's involved in this kind of work, would be that greater funding would be allocated, that that whoever is making those decisions at the provincial level recognizes that there is a need there, and that there is that base funding that is allocated so that we can help these people, and that we can shorten these wait lists and eliminate these wait lists, that people aren't slipping through the gaps, because what happens, I mean, people die this way.
Right.
When those signs are missed, that's when you have people who we lose, and we really shouldn't be losing these people.
People decide to get help and then go and get help and find out they have to wait 6 months for help, and then perhaps they figure, well, I guess I'm just not meant to be helped.
Well, it's tough, and you really want to get to those people in those moments of crisis, because it's a critical time. It's a point in time when we really have to be there to be able to step up for them, to wrap around that person and provide support, because without it, you know, it can be a crisis, and it should be something that we can avoid.
Is it purely a crisis of funding, though? Is it like do you have services you can access, but you have only so much budget, or is it a combination of things?
Well, I think it probably is a combination of things, but I see, because I think that attitude has changed and people understand that it is a priority. I don't think anybody disagrees with that at that point, or they're a very small minority and not a popular opinion to still share. But as far as people actually being able to get the help that they need, I think we've done a good job in getting people comfortable in talking about it, or at least making more steps in that direction. But it is a fact of typically base funding can be part of it in being able to provide more services that are not rigidly allocated for one thing or another. It's great, I mean, to have funding that goes toward a particular program or service, but right. there often can come with very strict controls around that for good reason. But without some more freedom to be able to allocate and be creative with how to help people, then sometimes you're kept into boxes. And so part of that is about giving a bit more flexibility in terms of how those funds are spent to be able to find creative ways of helping people. But some of it is just, I think, simply that the money isn't there to be able to hire the appropriate people or have better tools or yeah. whatever it is to be able to help these people.
I think that's something people fundamentally don't understand about how a lot of government funding works, that you have X amount for service A to deal with problem B. And perhaps you are somewhere where there aren't as many people who need service A for problem B. They need actually service Y to deal with problem Z, and then there's maybe no money there, and you're having to struggle and come up with the metrics in order to convince higher levels of government, who are of course themselves being inundated with requests from all corners.
Right. And so sometimes what you might end up with is having services that are tailored to just meeting whatever the criteria is for funding mm-hmm. instead of actually perhaps being tailored to address the actual need that is there. Mm-hmm. I think that would be an extreme example. Not to say that's always the case, but
right.
But that's what could happen if taken to that extreme of, okay, well, the money that we can actually get is in this box, and so it doesn't matter if somebody has a different need. You know, we're not going to be able to provide services for that need without the funding, so we get funding for this, so let's do this. That's mm-hmm. That's maybe a blunt analogy of what can happen.
Right.
And so that's why the need for a bit more flexibility is there.
Yeah. One of the things that does strike me in doing these sorts of interviews is the intersectionality of problems that, you know, the siloing effect. Like mental health problems, you can't just tie it off and say that's we need a mental health policy, or
sure.
post-secondary issues, we can't tie that off and come up with that policy separate. Your group recognizes that too, because I was exploring your website mm-hmm. and there was this post about how supporting mental health is good for business. And
right.
that, you know, when you sort of phrase it that you have $500 million of lost productivity because mm-hmm. people can't get the mental health services they need, this becomes, well, tell me about that, because
about
that's,
productivity,
yeah,
sure.
yeah.
Well, what we realize right now, and I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but there is a significant amount of lost productivity Canada-wide. I think it was something like $500 million,
mm-hmm.
Accounting for, or maybe it was 500,000 Canadians mm-hmm. are missing work due to mental health related reasons at any given day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I'm going to look at the numbers later and I'm going to shake my head at myself. But there's a significant portion of our population who are not showing up to work because of a mental health issue, and that does equate to lost productivity. And if you take care of those people, well, then that comes back around. I think going back to one of your earlier points, none of these things exist in isolation.
Right.
And so it's about seeing a bigger picture approach. That's why we also recognize that mental health issues and addictions issues are not separate issues, but they
right.
can often be intertwined. One might lead to another, mm-hmm. or they might be more likely to occur when one is already there. That's why it's so important to also have that housing piece there, to make sure that people have social supports, that they're able to have a community that's looking after them, whether that's a group of friends or mentors or just other people that are looking out for them and being able to provide support. Because none of these things can be just solved in one piece. It takes all of those pieces being addressed collectively to be able to give people the kinds of supports that they need. A really interesting model, which I've learned about in my time at the CMHA, is looking at both the severity of what somebody is dealing with,
mm-hmm.
and that could be, you can look at it on a scale, like a 1 to 5, let's say. And at the same token, you can have that same 1 to 5 level of the social supports that they have. Do they have safe and secure housing? Do they have, are they in a good neighborhood? Do they have support of family or friends or people that are looking out for them? And depending on how much support that they have, then they're at a greater likelihood to be able to withstand mental health or addictions issues. The lower down you get, the fewer supports you have, then the harder it is to be able to rebound from those same sorts of things. And so it's about being able to make sure that people are given as much of a chance as possible to succeed, to have support, so that they're not ending up in a place where then we actually have to really provide some extra support.
Well, I found the phrasing interesting, and I don't know if it was intentionally meant to appeal to, you know, the business side of things, because also the opposite is true, that their economic pressures are a stressor for mental health. And that could be like people not making enough money or not being able to afford a place to live or not being able to afford, you know, a sensible diet. And, you know, living on the margins takes its toll.
Absolutely, it does. You've got it right there. And so you're right, money is always a stressor. And so that's another part of the puzzle. But when it goes back to the workplace productivity, just as it's true that there are so many Canadians missing work because of mental health, you know, if you can support those people and get them help then and get them back to work in a timely fashion, I think people show a greater appreciation for a workplace that does prioritize mental health, that does say, hey, you know, it's okay to take a day off if you're not feeling well and you don't have to, you don't have to come in with a doctor's note. You can just, you know, we believe you if you say you're not well. And you don't have to come in with a whole list of explanations. I think that returns. If somebody puts that trust in you, that say, you know what, today I get that you're probably not feeling well, take the day off. I'm going to want to be more motivated to come back in the next day and say, thanks for that. I really needed that day. And I appreciate that. And you put more effort in return. I think that's where the workplace benefits come from. A whole lot smarter people than me have costed it out in terms of what those sorts of supports provide and how much productivity can be gained and how many cents on the dollar or whatever can be gained by having good workplace mental health policies. But I do know that the numbers are there that they support that it, you know, making it a priority is good for business.
And the whole doctor's note thing, that's kind of controversial even for just, you know, I had the flu yesterday and once saw the doctor. But in the case of mental health, it's particularly difficult because that's that stigma we're talking about, because if, you know, people still feel that, you know, they could be free to a certain amount to talk about their mental health issues, but perhaps not to the extent like I'm seeing a doctor about it.
Well, yeah, and one thing that we know is as many Canadians are dealing with a mental health issue, a significant chunk of those people are not going to see a doctor about that. And so those are the people that, you know, you worry about and you hope are getting support that they need. So that they're not falling through the cracks and it doesn't become something worse that couldn't have been or that could have been prevented. Because you're right, people, it is still a challenge. You have to still break through that belief that for whatever reason, to have a mental health issue or challenge is to be perceived as weak or to be perceived as, you know, melodramatic or over-exaggerating whatever you're dealing with. And so until we can do that, and I think we continue to do that and try and break that down. And it helps to have people, again, who are sharing their stories and are a much more public platform to say, okay, if Ryan Reynolds has challenges with anxiety, then it's okay for me to have challenges with anxiety too. Yeah, that's the other side of things because, yes, people don't necessarily go and get help. And we're trying to fix that. But again, in order to do that, it takes some more funding too to be able to help those people.
The other big piece of it that I wanted to talk about was because housing is a big issue generally, but this the idea of supportive housing. How is that? What is supportive housing, and maybe how is that different from what we typically think of as social housing?
Sure. Well, we offer supportive housing through the Canadian Mental Health Association, Waterloo-Wellington. We have units throughout the area. And what it just means is that you're giving people a chance. Let's say they've had a significant mental health or addiction issue, and they're looking for a place. It's going to be made more affordable for them to get into there in the first place. And so in our case, we will pay market value to a landlord to rent out that unit, and then the actual tenant would pay a subsidized amount of that, and then we would top up that amount. Well, what happens is they pay the landlord and we top up the landlord for the remaining amount of whatever the place would actually be worth.
Okay.
And so that's part of the social element, that it's more affordable for somebody to get into that unit. But then there's also people that are, if not embedded in there, then they're coming by on a regular or semi-regular basis to check in with that person and see how are things going. You know, are there anything issues that are going on? If you have employment issues, we have employment services. We can refer to that. If there are other issues going on, well, we have all these X, Y, and Z programs. Maybe you want to come back and give this one a try. And so it's about having somebody who's looking out for that person in there. But so much of that is just giving somebody a place to stay, because that right away eliminates so many of the problems that can present themselves. I think people deserve and need that ability to feel safe and have a place of their own. And when they have that, that makes a world of a difference already.
Is there a model where it is you're not renting for market value, but it's something like social housing where it's kind of dedicated and administered by some level of government, whether that's the county, whether that's the city, whether that's the province?
I don't know.
No.
The best answer I have is I don't know. Yeah, I know what works for us and what we do.
Right.
I know that it's worked well. Again, it's a challenge of being able to provide support for all the people that are needing that, because again, it's a service where the demand greatly exceeds the amount that we're able to supply.
Yeah.
And that would be the same for any other provider, I'm sure. Those are sometimes very long wait lists that any community experiences for social housing, for subsidized housing, because it's challenging, especially in this area, being in that Greater Toronto bubble. Prices go up very quickly.
Yeah. I was going to say that it's the fair market value thing kind of sticks in me, because, you know, could your dollar value go further if you weren't paying the fair market value? It probably could, but it's I think that's one of those issues that a lot of housing issues here, you know, is, you know, maybe a bigger problem than two people in a booth can solve. But we're trying. Can you talk a bit about this is getting dangerously close to a partisan question, but we do have a career civil service, but in terms of the support you get from different levels of government, how do you grade that? You don't have to give it a letter grade, but I mean, are they sympathetic to the needs and the gaps, or is it very bureaucratic in it? It's that, you know, we have what we have, and
I'm pretty encouraged by the relationships that we have. So we are a provincially funded not-for-profit. We deal with the Waterloo-Wellington Local Health Integration Network. They provide a significant amount of our funding. We also deal with a few different provincial ministries. So the Ministry of Child and Youth Services, MCYS, Ministry of Advanced Education and Skills Development, Ministry of Community and Social Services. I think I'm getting those acronyms right. So we have a number of different ministry fundings and the LIN. And I would say with all of those, it's pretty good relationships. The LIN is quite interested in what we're doing. And they're a part of meetings quite frequently and wondering, okay, how is this money being spent? What are your needs? How can we help you more? I think we have a really good relationship with them, and we're encouraged by them. And so I think that is an absolute positive. My hope is, with all of the promises that we've seen from these major political parties leading up to June 9th, that the money that's been promised on the table, whether it's $2.1 billion or $2.4 or $1.9 billion, that happens, because it would make such a world of a difference. Now, also, that's not to say that a one-time shot of funding is going to make
right.
It's about long-term commitment. And so, you know, a one-time funding is one thing, and it's great, but it's about that ongoing investment in realizing that this is not going to be solved as a Band-Aid quick solution, but in terms of prioritizing it in the long term.
Right, and that's something I was thinking about, that it's how do you turn awareness? I think we have the awareness piece. And now it's a question of how to turn that into action, because it's not just what parties promise and what parties deliver, but it's also about people like you who are working in the system and your colleagues and having to devise, you know, strategy, how to work with your partners in order to create that long-term vision. So, you know, what is that process like?
Well, you know, we try and do everything that we can within the bounds of, you know, we know what we get from the province and what we get from donors and funders, and we try to make that go as far as possible. Mm-hmm. In whatever ways we can. We have people who are really creative and really smart finding different ways of, okay, what if we structured our service like this, and how can we better provide services to a person coming in who needs help? One really cool example of that would be flexible assertive community treatment. It's a model that we have made a greater priority for our organization. The idea being for that is that an individual would be working with a team, and so you would have an occupational therapist that you might see. You would have counselors on that. You might have, I don't know, dietitians or psychologists or anybody else who might be part of that team who is working with the same person, and they're interacting with each other and with that person, and they know, okay, right now this person might need a lot of support. Next week, maybe they don't need as much support, and we can kind of be flexible and adapt to whatever they're going through so that we're helping them at the level of need that they have at any given time. So that's one example of how we have kind of modified our services to adapt to what we're working with. I think we'll do more and more of that. But again, it's just trying to find, okay, how can we help people with what we have? And we hope that, you know, with more funding and with being able to encourage more donations, that will have a bit more flexibility for people to be able to, again, come up with ideas that might not necessarily fall within a box that would be provided by ministry funding, but that we could say, okay, we're not going to get specifically allocated funds for this, but we've got enough funds that are raised to allow you to try this out, see if it works, and we can go from there.
Are you worried that, you know, after the election, you know, there could be the delivery of funds, but that, you know, we have politicians who might be thinking about mental health issues as kind of a cool way to look, you know, like you're in tune, like you recognize there's a need to help people, and that once the political pressure of offering things is gone, that you're back to having to be creative and having to find ways to help as many people as possible with many of the same resources you have now.
I mean, it's a possibility. It would be far from the first time where something has been brought up in terms of anyone's campaign. It doesn't end up necessarily happening. I'm encouraged, if anything, that we do have the commitment so far from these parties that have made it a priority. And I think that's testament to the attitudes that have changed around the province and around the country, that it is a priority, that people are asking their constituents, or the constituents are asking their elected officials and their candidates, hey, what's in your platform? What are you going to do for my community in this area? I think that's encouraging. And so I would like to give people the benefit of the doubt that post-election, that it is going to remain a priority. I know it will still be a priority for us and for many people who live across this province, because it does affect so many people. But yeah, you hope that that people would stick to the promises and pledges that they've made.
It's a double election year too. So is there a way that you're going to be creating awareness in the municipal campaigns, and, you know, both here and in the Waterloo area? That is there any, I guess, intersection there where, you know, the municipality can help you out too, or is this like merely provincial jurisdiction?
Well, I don't think it's merely provincial, because we do work with our municipalities too. I think we have good relationships and support from our different municipal leaders and city councils, governments, because we do see them at different events, even if it's something as simple as Mental Health Week at the start of May. And having elected officials supporting us in wearing green on a day, having them recognizing, okay, this is happening on this day, or showing up at our different community events or annual general meetings, for them to be supportive of that. I think, yes, municipal matters, because it's we do see issues whether it is something like a local opioid crisis, where you're focusing more on what's happening right here within the Guelph area, or whether it's anything that's impacting a local community, then we are working with the municipal partners and with other community organizations, whether that's public health or another provider, to, again, support people the best way we can in the community.
Okay. Let's play a quick hypothetical. You get 5 minutes with either Premier Wynne or Mr. Ford or Ms. Horvath or even our own local party leader, Mr. Schreiner, and you get the chance to pitch them on the one thing you need money or assistance on in order to make the work of the CMHA better. What's the thing you pitch?
Yeah, and I feel like I'm going to give a cop out answer here because I don't think it can be one thing. It has to be many things. It has to be that multifaceted approach. Mm-hmm. I think if we're getting the money, it's got to go to a lot of things. It's got to go to housing, but it's also got to go to providing more, social workers, counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists. It's got to go to our programs and services. It's got to go to our employment services to make sure that people have advocates who are helping them find meaningful work if they're out of work and looking to get back in the workforce. It's got to go to all of these things, and it can't just go to one place because it does take more than just one thing to solve this. It's not the answer you're looking for. It's the one I'm giving you, though.
Well, it's fair enough. If people want to learn more about the CMHA, where can you direct them?
Sure. CMHA Waterloo Wellington would be your starting place. CMHAWW.ca if you're online. By all means, you can also come into any one of our offices. We have our head office at 80 Waterloo Avenue in Guelph. Ask for Martin if you want to. If I'm around, I'd be happy to come down and talk to you. We have brochures and all that. I've tried to do in my time, CMHA put together videos in our programs and services too. And so I would say if you're curious about the kinds of people that are involved in what we do, if you want to know more about individual programs and services, that's a starting place. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on YouTube. If you frequent any of those platforms, by all means, we try and do a good job of sharing resources there and also giving an idea of different programs or services or events that we're putting on. So I would say wherever you normally kind of find yourself, we're probably there in some capacity.
Just not here. present in the CFRU studio. But Martin Bauman, thank you so much for your time today, and good mental health to you.
Well, thanks, Adam. I appreciate you being so patient with my evasiveness.
You're not the first.
Yeah, I know.
And once again, that was Martin Bauman, Communications Specialist for the Canadian Mental Health Association of Waterloo Wellington. And you can learn more about him and the entire array of services and programs offered by the CMHA at cmhaww.ca. And if you need immediate help, you can also call the CMHA helpline at 1-866-531-2600. That's 1-866-531-2600. And that's all for the Guelph Politicast this week. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics' Ed Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.